The conference is now being recorded.
All right, so thank you to everybody who joined today. I'm Kim Mobley, NASEP's Director of Communications and Member Services, and this is our webinar on how to ensure your program is exceptional and introduction to NASEP standards. If you are having problems with the presentation, feel free to send me an email during it, kmobley@nasep.org, and I will try to finagle figuring that out in the middle of the webinar. Otherwise, we will make this available afterwards, so I will be happy to get you a copy. Because there's a variety of people joining this webinar, you know, looking over the attendee list, we were really excited to see that there are familiar names, but there's also a lot of you who are relatively new to NASEP or you're participating in a NASEP event for the first time. So we're just going to take a brief moment to introduce the organization before I turn it over to our presenters. You know, many of you know that our membership network includes universities, high schools, state agencies. We have over 260 colleges and universities, dozens of high schools, and 13 state agencies. And we support that network of dual and concurrent enrollment professionals by sharing the latest knowledge about best practices, research efforts, advocacy with media, state agencies, and with the government. And our membership gets involved in a lot of different ways to facilitate dialogue and information sharing. And, you know, if you are new to us and this is your first time participating in an event, we hope that, you know, you'll get involved and become more active in sharing your expertise and your knowledge about your program and what you're doing. Because we definitely learn by sharing, you know, across state borders and across the country. Our annual conference, which is being held in Chicago this year in October, features 2 days of presentations on all the latest innovations and provides other opportunities for professional development through workshops and webinars and whatnot. So we hope that you'll get involved in that as well. NASEP's 15 years old, but it traces its roots a bit further back than that when a handful of long-established programs sought each other out. And one of the concerns of those founders in the 90s was that the quality of the programs being offered wasn't up to par. And so they wanted to not only create a membership organization, but also to adopt a set of standards and a peer review accreditation process, which, you know, that's why we're having this webinar and the focus of what we're talking about today. You know, with over 1 in 6 students matriculating to college after having successfully completed a dual or concurrent enrollment course, the need for upholding standards is greater than ever. And NASEP has the only set of standards of excellence for concurrent enrollment partnerships, and they serve as a model for statewide quality standards in 6 states and are recognized or endorsed by a number of other professional organizations. Last year, we took an important step to continue the growth of our accredited service in the professionalization, by establishing our NASEP Accreditation Commission, which is an autonomous unit of NASEP to manage that process and to review the peer review team reports, make accreditation decisions, and further develop our accreditation policies. And I'm pleased to have two of our commission team members with us today presenting, our Accreditation Commission Chair, Jacqueline Dumond, who's the Manager of School Partnerships at the University of Southern Indiana, and our Vice Chair, Victoria Zeppelin, who's the Director of College Now at Tompkins-Portland Community College in New York. And with that, I will turn it over to Jacqueline.
Thank you, Kim. I did want to ask you, Kim, if you could maybe move the presentation back. Okay, there we go. I was seeing a little tiny screen, and since...
Yes, I wasn't paying attention to it while I was talking.
Okay.
So now I'm in full control of the Prezi, and I will be from here on out.
Excellent. Okay. So, yes, I'm Jacqueline Dumond, Chair of the Accreditation Commission, and I'm at the University of Southern Indiana in Evansville. We're in the TOE. USI is a comprehensive regional 4-year public institution, and we've had a concurrent enrollment program for 29 years. I believe we're having a birthday next year, so that's pretty exciting for us. And I've been with the program for just over 10 years and with NASEP for what feels like twice that long. No, I'm just kidding. I've had an exceptional experience working with NASEP, and so I wanted to put in a little plug for not only attending the conference, which I think is extremely important for our professional development as program administrators or people who are involved with it as faculty liaisons. There are a number of folks with different avenues to attend the conference. But also to get involved with NASEP as a volunteer. Until recently, it was a completely volunteer-run organization. We now have 2.5 staff members, but there are still tons of things that you can do as a volunteer one of the first ways I got involved was on the communications committee. Then I got involved as an accreditation reviewer, and it snowballed from there, and here I am on this webinar. So if you are a person who has a hard time saying no, NACEP is the organization for you. But seriously, it is a really great organization to deepen your understanding of concurrent enrollment, to learn about the best practices, and to network with some fabulous people. So get involved. That's my plug there. I will let Victoria introduce herself, and then she will give you a little bit of history behind our standards.
Great. Thanks, Jacqueline. And so as you heard from Kim, I'm with the College Now program at Tompkins Courtland Community College, which is known as TC3 in our neck of the woods. We're just a small community college located outside of Ithaca in the Finger Lakes region. We offer both liberal arts and technical courses in close to 50 schools across central New York. So we actually have quite a large program in relation to the size of our college. I've been with TC3 for almost 10 years now, starting in the tech prep program before moving into concurrent enrollment. And before that, I was a middle school science teacher. And just to reiterate what Jacqueline was saying about getting involved with NACEP, I remember I attended my first conference before our college got accreditation. We've been accredited since 2007. And I've been attending the conferences, finding them really valuable, and really started volunteering at the conferences, doing presentations, and then work doing the accreditation commission just over the past few years, and have found it really fulfilling. So I encourage you to get involved. I guess Kim is going to steer the slide. So I know that she gave you a little bit of background on the history, but I wanted to dive a bit deeper into that just since some of you are really new to NACEP as an organization. First, at a meeting in 1999, 20 founding institutions came together to officially establish NACEP. They adopted bylaws and a mission statement, and really, as Kim was saying, this is a period of rapid expansion for concurrent enrollment, and a key concern was the quality of the college classes being offered through these kinds of partnerships. NACEP's founders included some of the nation's oldest and most prominent concurrent enrollment partnerships, who shared a common belief that institutions of higher ed should follow certain best practices to ensure the quality of college classes taught by high school teachers. And so that, to that end, NACEP adopted the national standards in 2002. These standards included measurable criteria in 5 categories, which are considered markers of excellence: curriculum, faculty, students, assessment, and program evaluation. Then in 2004, the first 4 concurrent enrollment programs were accredited after a team of peers carefully reviewed their documentation on how each program met NACEP standards. Then 5 years later, the NACEP Board of Directors adopted a revised version of the standards in 2009, and it took a couple of years of getting member input and board deliberation to develop those new standards. And it's under those standards that we're operating now. And so as you can see, NACEP, you know, we started from just 20 institutions in 1999, and we've now grown to over 260 post-secondary institutions, with 89 of those being accredited programs across 18 states. And we're right now in our in a new accreditation cycle, and we'll be announcing in May the next set of accredited programs. Jacqueline will now talk to you about the definition of concurrent enrollment.
All right. So it does make a little bit of sense before we dive into what those standards entail to talk about what do we mean when we say concurrent enrollment. If your states are anything like mine, we're very confused. There are millions of terms that mean different things from state to state, and as I've served as an accreditation reviewer for a few years, and I can tell you that it's everywhere. There are so many overlapping definitions. So nationally, NACEP does try to promote the definition of concurrent enrollment as college credit-bearing courses taught to high school students by college-approved high school teachers. So the important part of the definition is that the person providing the instruction is the high school teacher. There are probably other models represented on this call, maybe even run through your office, and that might be called by the same name as your program, and that's okay. But when it comes time to think about your accreditation application and the standards that you have in place, we are concerned at NACEP with those courses taught in the high school or through another modality, but the primary instruction giver is the high school teacher. The reason that we don't get super concerned about those other models in the accreditation application and those models shouldn't be included is because those models are accredited through your regional accreditors, because the instruction is provided by your own faculty member, whether that's a professor on loan model, high school students coming to your campus, or through online or hybrid coursework offered through your college or university. So just wanted to be clear on that definition, and at some point in here, the phrase dual credit may escape my lips, and I don't mean to confuse you with that, but in Indiana, our terms are interchangeable, so I will try to stop being a Hoosier for the next hour, but it's very difficult. So I will now move on to a little bit about the program description, and we do have the five standards, and those are at the bottom of the screen, and we're going to talk very in-depth about those. In terms of those of you who are considering in the near future, perhaps, putting together an accreditation application, I did want you to know that there's also an additional piece called a program description. It is not technically one of our 17 standards, but it's a very important piece that provides background for the reviewers and sort of gives the context of the history of your institution, where your program is housed, the history of your program itself, and the current size of your program, the scope, the number of students, schools, faculty liaisons, instructors. It helps your reviewers know, okay, when you said you haven't had any new instructors, is that because you have a small program with five teachers? Or is that because, you know, is there a reason to be concerned? Basically, this helps us know if there are any red flags. So this is not something that you would develop far, far in advance, so I'm not going to spend any more time on it, but just know if you do end up applying, there will be that background piece where you tell us a little bit about your program. So we're going to move to the first standard, which is curriculum, and Victoria will talk to you about that.
Yes, thank you, Jacqueline. So as I said, there are the five areas, and each of these areas has three or four standards embedded within them. As Jacqueline and I go through them, what we really tried to do was to just come up with some of the highlights, the key elements for these standards that you need to kind of take away with you. What you'll notice is that there is not necessarily a one-to-one correspondence between the bullets we have and the standards, as you'll find them listed on the NACEP website. We really just, again, wanted to make sure that you had some good takeaway messages about what these categories all mean for as you're going through the process of your self-study and evaluation of your program. The curriculum area, as it says, really the essence is looking at the curriculum in the high schools, and is that matching? Are those courses that you're offering in the high schools actual college courses? So just like what you would find in your college catalog, matching the title, the number of credits, the description, and everything, are these actual college courses? These should not be courses that were just created for your high school partners. Each CEP course must match what is in your college catalog and be offered regularly on your campus. So that's first off, and something to make sure that you have. We sometimes have issues around special topics classes and things like that, and so if you have some special situations, that is something that you'll want to talk with someone at NACEP about to explore if you have some things that are kind of less clear-cut. In addition, to help ensure alignment in curriculum, philosophy, and the expectations in the courses, as well as build collegiality between your campus, faculty, and the concurrent enrollment instructors, your faculty should be visiting the concurrent enrollment instructors and their classes. These site visits do not need to be done every year, but it's wise to do at least one in an instructor's first year, and then after that, you would get them on whatever cycle makes sense for you. So like for our campus, We have a cycle here for when our on-campus adjuncts are visited, and we set the same guidelines for our concurrent enrollment adjuncts as far as how often they need to be visited. The visits should be performed by a faculty member. Either a full-time or adjunct faculty member assigned, or an academic officer with authority over curriculum or faculty in that discipline. So not, let's say, an administrator just in charge of outreach or distance learning at your college. It really is an academic officer. Most often, the site visits involve some sort of class observation combined with a pre- and or post-conference. Sometimes the visits might include an exchange of course materials, maybe guest lectures by the liaison, even professional development. In any case, you need to track these visits and keep records about what happened at the visit, including any recommendations by the liaison regarding the course. Most programs create a standard form for the liaisons to use for these site visits, where they would indicate, you know, who they're visiting, what class they teach, when they went, and what they did in the class. Did they look at the course outline, the textbooks being used, and then giving their feedback about them, how well they were aligned, what was class discussion like, did they talk with students in the classroom? Giving any kind of feedback they can about that so that you know whether they think the course is aligned or whether there are any concerns, red flags that need to be followed up upon. Okay, so that's really the gist of the curriculum area, and then Jacqueline will now take on faculty.
Okay, so there are four areas within the faculty standard. The first has to do with who is reviewing the credentials for your concurrent enrollment instructors and whether or not those instructors meet the same criteria as adjunct faculty on your campus. So we're not talking about do they qualify to teach a 400-level majors biology course. Most of our campuses have different criteria for those intro courses than they do for the upper level, and so we're talking about could this person be hired to teach that course on campus as adjunct faculty. The academic department, not HR, and not the person in charge of the concurrent enrollment program should be the one reviewing those credentials and approving them. NACEP doesn't require that you have pre-approval site visits, although as a personal recommendation, I do think that's a good idea so that your faculty member can go out and see what's happening in that classroom and get a feel for the person. That's just something that we've learned over the years. The second bullet point has to do with the initial training for newly approved instructors. And I will step back and say bullets 2 and 3 tend to be what trip up most of the applicants who apply for accreditation and even some of our reaccreditation applicants. When it comes to these trainings and the annual discipline-specific professional development, there's often the biggest problem, I think, has been documenting what's happening. So let me talk about what should be happening and then maybe a few ideas for how you can get started with that. So the second point is that new instructors, before they ever teach your course, need to sit down with someone from the faculty. Maybe it's the liaison who's over that area. Maybe it's a department or division chair, but someone who knows, here's what goes on in the course, and here are our expectations. If you have common assessment pieces, that's when that needs to be conveyed, or if there's a test bank where everyone draws questions for the final exam. Those are the types of conversations that need to be taking place before this person ever teaches your course. In addition to that discipline-specific, course-specific training that needs to happen, that instructor also needs to meet with someone from your program to learn how do students enroll, what is the process for that, who pays and when, are there prerequisites for the course or other kinds of testing that the students have to go through, what are the expectations for me as an instructor, you know, how often do I need PD, and who will be coming to my classroom to observe, and how often do I put in the grades, all of those sorts of administrative duties, they need to have that understanding prior to teaching in the course. So often this initial training happens one-on-one or in very small groups, and I understand that that makes it difficult to track. One thing that our program did was develop a new instructor orientation checklist Some of our liaisons are very, and I'm sure you all are probably nodding your head. Some of your liaisons are very conscientious and they don't need very much assistance at all. They know exactly what they want to do and they get it done and they give you everything that you want on time. But then there are some other liaisons that we work with who don't always quite meet the deadlines and they don't always quite remember what it is that they're supposed to talk about. And so we developed this checklist so that we had consistency across our new instructor orientation so that we knew everybody at least saw, oh yes, I'm supposed to talk about this area. It's very easy when you sit down informally with someone to chat about these things to forget places. So we wanted to make sure, have you talked about the grading scale? Have you talked about the final exam policy? Have you talked about what should and should not be in a syllabus? All of those sorts of things. So if anyone would like to see our orientation checklist, I'm more than happy to share that. That's what NASEP is all about, is stealing ideas from each other. So you can email accreditation@nasep.org, and I'll be happy to ship that to you along with any other documents that I happen to mention through the course of the presentation. The third bullet point talks about what are the activities that you provide for your continuing instructors, your veterans. The standard itself, if you were to pull it up, talks about annual discipline-specific professional development activities. The individual facilitating these activities needs to be somebody from that academic department, from the faculty. It can be your liaison. It can be somebody higher up than that, if it's more appropriate for your director of composition, for example, to do that. But the intent of this area is to make sure that your program is offering these discipline-specific professional development events annually and that there is attendance happening from your teachers, that you have an expectation, a published policy, which kind of gets into that final point on this slide, but that you have set down a policy. So, for example, we expect our instructors to be there every year. We do pay them and feed them, so that certainly helps. But we also say, if you need to miss a year, that's okay, but you will need to come back the following year. So we don't allow them to go more than every other year without attending. And that's not really been an issue for us, but that has been the expectation from the beginning. Some of you may not have already established that expectation, so again, that's going to be a challenge for you, is to change the culture of your program. I know that some high school teachers who might be involved might be saying, gosh, if I have to go to one extra thing, I don't think I really want to do this. And so that's a challenge. That's a challenge. Some folks can't offer that professional development during the summer because of union issues. Some can, some can pay, some can't. Food is a universal language there, so I would recommend, some really good catering if at all possible. But again, this area with the annual PD and then the upfront training, these are the areas that most programs have problems documenting. And within this third point with the annual professional development, just to let you know, in an accreditation application, you will be asked to provide an example of professional development activities from every single discipline that you offer. We have 17 disciplines we work with on our campus, so that is no small thing to put together. And just like with instructors, with your faculty, if you can set that expectation up front that you are going to be doing this, ideally you're paying them so that they, or giving them course release time or some other kind of incentive to help support the program, but collecting that documentation of the PD activities, collecting the documentation of the visits, if you can set that expectation up front, then when you're ready to put your application together, it won't be quite as cumbersome. It's still a lot of work, I won't lie to you, but if everybody knows what the expectations are, then hopefully that will make your life a little easier down the road. The final point in this area, which I've alluded to, is that your program has an expectation for attendance at the annual professional development event, as well as expectations regarding the course delivery and the content. And so that's what we call our non-compliance policy. We don't want to necessarily see that you've decertified a teacher, but we want to know for your own protection, basically, that you have a policy in place so that if somebody is willfully, you know, just ignoring your suggestions and not doing what they need to be doing in order to offer your course, then you have steps outlined and you have recourse and this is what we're going to do next. And then after a certain point, you know, you would be no longer with our program. So that's the F standards. We're going to move on now with Victoria to the student standards.
Thanks. So for the student area, things to keep in mind are that students intending to earn college credit need to be registered for the college courses and have those courses and grades recorded on your college's transcript. The policies around registration should be consistent with those for your campus students. So, for example, you don't wait until the very end of the course to register students for the class, or students shouldn't be withdrawn at the end of your course just because their grades were poor. So really, you'd be looking at what your campus policies are around registration, drop, withdrawal deadlines, and so on, when academic penalties incurred or not, and follow those same kinds of policies. Generally, students are registered as non-matriculated, non-degree-seeking students, but registrars may vary in their designations for the concurrent enrollment students. That's okay. As part of the application, the registrar will just be submitting a letter to explain how the students are registered. Now, as far as NACEP is concerned, blended or mixed classes are permitted. That means that you can have students who are earning college credit in the same classroom with students who aren't registered for college credit. That is really up to your college and your school partners if they want to allow that, to have students in the room, some who are trying to get the college grade and some who are just taking the course for high school credit. The same thing goes if the student withdraws from the college class. They generally could stay in the room and continue to earn a high school credit. You know, that's something there that you, your college and your schools would need to figure out. Some colleges, mine for example, we register the non-college credit seeking students as audits so that their presence is tracked in the classroom. The next piece here, which maybe applies sometimes more to community colleges than to four-year schools, but really it's kind of across the board. Colleges often have certain prerequisite or placement testing requirements for classes. The requirements for your concurrent enrollment students should be aligned with those for regular college students. So if there's a certain reading and writing level that they need in order to take an English or a history course, should be consistent, or if they need a certain level of math to be able to take a science class or something. These things need to be consistent. There are times when there might be some flexibility around things. For example, we offer intermediate foreign language classes. But the students may not have the beginning Spanish classes, let's say, that we offer. So we say that, well, it's that beginning Spanish or the equivalent at the high school, and the schools will track that the student has fulfilled that requirement around having that beginning language in order to take the intermediate level language. So you just need to be able to document that. Now, the final point here is around the student handbook. All colleges have some kind of handbook, set of policies, rules, and regulations for students. It's okay for you to use your college's handbook as long as it's relevant to the concurrent enrollment students and includes all the things that they need to know. Some programs find it easier to develop their own student handbook so that everything the student needs is in one place. Other programs I've seen will link to the relevant parts of the college handbook and then supplement that with any content that's specific to the concurrent enrollment students. So you'll need to look and see what works best for your program. The major thing to keep in mind around the handbook is that it needs to be publicly available and accessible to your students. So that they really understand what their responsibilities are and the rules are around being a college student, because that's what they are. Next, Jacqueline, for assessment.
All right. Assessment is one of the other big, meaty, and potentially troublesome areas for our accreditation applicants. So there are three particular areas underneath this. And the idea is that the on-campus sections of the courses and the CEP sections are consistent in terms of the learning objectives, course objectives, learning outcomes, whatever you call them, that concept. What is it that students are supposed to know and be able to do at the end of this course, as well as consistency in the grading scales and the methods that are used to assess how or if students are meeting those learning expectations and outcomes. So for each of these areas, your program would be asked in the process of the accreditation application to articulate the processes by which these expectations are evaluated. So when your liaisons visit the classrooms, when they conduct these annual professional development events, is that when this information is conveyed, when changes are conveyed? What's the conversation about this assessment piece that happens during that initial training, during F2, when you have a new instructor who is just finding out how your course is taught, what the course philosophy is? And so for each of these areas, you're going to be asked to articulate, how do we ensure that these are consistent? What kinds of reports do you run internally? Do you do like a grade check? And are we assigning way too many A's on the CEP sections as opposed to what happens on campus? There's all different kinds of ways that the liaisons and the instructors can sit down and discuss these areas. So, for example, in terms of the grading scales and how do you know that an A in the CEP means really the same thing as an A in the on-campus section, you can have shared assessment pieces like the rubrics. And if, again, your department uses a common rubric and requires that in all sections, then your CEP instructor should be doing the same thing. If everybody in a chemistry class is using the American Chemical Society standardized test at the end, then all of the CEP instructors need to be doing that too. And that builds into this section. Developing a test bank for questions together with your on-campus faculty and the CEP faculty, conducting grade benchmarking activities. If any of you are composition people, you'll probably recognize this activity, but our composition people every year get together with student work and they sit down and they grade it and they talk about whether the grading was comparable across the sections and across what happens here on our campus. So there's all different kinds of activities, and you all are probably doing some very creative things as well. This assessment piece is really kind of the heart of what gets discussed in those annual activities as well as during the initial orientation. And the documentation in this area is pretty intense. For one area, you are matching syllabi for each of your discipline areas. And then for another area, you're matching either the syllabi with the assessment methods highlighted, or you're actually showing common assessment pieces, whether that be essays or, quizzes of some type or a final exam, speech rubrics, whatever it might be. So there's a lot of documentation that happens in this area. So again, if you are considering applying for accreditation, this would be another area where it's really great to set that expectation now with your faculty and your CEP instructors that we need to have these points of commonality. If it's happening on campus, it needs to happen in the CEP section, and then collecting that documentation. And this makes a really great topic for if you have a faculty member who says, I don't know what to talk about at the annual workshop. Well, let's talk about this. Have there been any changes in the assessment piece on campus? And do the CEP instructors know about it? So the next and final standard is evaluation, and that's back to Victoria.
Thanks. So the evaluations, they're basically, I think, of two different kinds. These are all program-level evaluations to distinguish them from the assessments that you do of students. These are the evaluations that help you as an administrator get a pulse of how your program's doing and how well it's meeting the needs in your community. So first you need to make sure that you have end-of-course evaluations that are taking place for each course section every time the class is offered. It doesn't matter if this is a teacher with 20 years of experience. they're going to still have those end-of-course evaluations taking place just like a brand-new concurrent enrollment instructor would. Most programs will just use what their college uses for a course evaluation tool, perhaps with some modifications. Some programs, you know, like on my campus for a while, they've been using kind of a paper or Scantron sort of form, and we just translated it into an online end of course evaluation tool that we can use. That was easier for us. So, but you need to make sure that that's taking place. The other kind of survey, this is the one that tends to be more complex to implement and does trip up some programs. This is where, as Jacqueline said, when you're applying for accreditation, you need to have everything in place. And this is something that most programs seeking accreditation maybe haven't had in place. The surveys of your former concurrent enrollment students as well as your high school partners. You need to be looking at surveying your most recent high school graduates, those that are 1 year out of high school, and doing those surveys every year. Okay? So every year you look at, you pull up your list of those students who graduated high school 1 year ago and you survey them and collect that information and evaluate it. Then every 3 years, you're going to be looking at those high school students that graduated 4 years ago, okay, and surveying them. You'll find that these surveys of your alums are just really valuable for learning how well your courses are serving your students as far as their knowledge, their skills, their confidence, and the transferability of credits. The four-year-out survey of alums is really nice for being able to see, well, now how did those students do in the long term? Were they able to graduate early or on time? How did they enrich their experience when they were at college as far as double major, study abroad, and so on? So it really gives some great information for you in evaluating your program and also some really nice pieces for your marketing materials and information to share back with schools. Because they want to know how well their students did after they left and went on to college. Finally, you'll want to survey your school partners. That includes your concurrent enrollment instructors and their principals and counselors in the schools. That's to get their views and kind of feedback on the program and the impact on the school as a whole and the culture in the school. Those school partner surveys are done every 3 years as well. NASA provides so-called essential questions for you to use for the surveys, and these questions are based on feedback from members about high-quality questions to ask. And all of that information is available on the NASEP website. When you look under accreditation resources and materials, you'll find information there listing the essential questions. You'll also find a survey guide, which is a great publication that was developed last year that gives tips on methodology for conducting the surveys, how to improve response rate, and so on. We've been asked before about response rate. NASEP does not have a minimum required level of response, but we do expect that programs are doing whatever they can to improve the response rate, and that includes having at least one follow-up contact after the initial survey was released. So all of that you can find in the survey guide on the NASEP website. Okay. Kim, I think it's up to you now.
Okay, so we're going to spend a few minutes talking about the accreditation timeline, and this may not be super applicable if you don't really have plans to apply anytime soon, but it is helpful to know that it is not an overnight process. From start to finish, it takes most programs 2+ years, from self-study to the end of the peer review process. First of all, though, we need to talk about eligibility. Who is even able to apply for accreditation or should be applying for accreditation? Our accreditation is of the post-secondary institution's concurrent enrollment program, not for a high school or a teacher. And the program needs to have been operational for at least 4 to 5 years because of the surveys Victoria was mentioning at the end. You can't survey your 4 year out students, I mean 4 years after high school graduation, if your program has only been in business for 2 years. So that's just, that can trip up some of the newer programs to hear about NACEF, and that's okay. Then the big one is really that all of the policies and procedures for the 17 standards that we've talked about today have been in place in the school year for which you're applying. So the application itself occurs in July, and so it's always based on the data from the immediately that prior academic year. So if you were doing all of the standards except evaluation, oh, we're going to go ahead and apply, and then we'll do that in the coming fall, that's not going to work. They all need to have been implemented, maybe not perfectly. Maybe there's room for improvement, and I will say we all always have room for improvement, and so that's okay if it's not perfect, but they do need to have at least been implemented prior to your application. In terms of the self-study, this happens now, basically. If you're thinking about applying for accreditation in 1 to 2 years, then you need to be in the self-study process, and that involves a serious look at the standards, your current practices, where do you meet them or exceed them, where do you think you're falling short, where do you have questions about, is this something that we can continue doing, or is this kind of a no-no in the world of NACEF? And again, when you conduct this self-study, you're looking at the NACEF defined part of your program that deals with concurrent enrollment for the reasons we've previously stated. So the standards certainly are applicable and helpful for those other models, but your application should only document that concurrent enrollment version. Then once you have gone through that, and Kim, I'll let you talk about coaching, so we'll skip over that little bullet point, but once you've decided that you think you're ready to apply, then by January 31st of each year, we collect what we call letters of intent. And these, it's basically a web form where you give us a little bit of the background about your program and some of your numbers. And then we ask some basic questions. You know, are your faculty conducting site visits? Are you implementing all of the evaluation standards at this point? And we ask about your discipline list. So you've kind of probably heard me refer to throughout this presentation, you know, one per discipline. And in a number of the standards, the evidence that we ask for does refer back to an academic discipline. So we like to look at that up front to make sure we're all on the same page with, is what you're calling a discipline, what we're calling a discipline. We really don't want to make our reviewers sift through an application where there are 35 different disciplines. That is way too large. On the other hand, if you're offering 80 courses and you come to us and say you only have 3 disciplines, then that's probably not going to be accurate, and we need to make that a little bit more finely cut. So that letter comes in, and with it, a non-refundable $100 fee. And then once that's been okayed, we move on to the application piece, which Victoria will talk about.
And again, since I know that not a lot of you are looking at applying in the immediate future, we won't spend a bunch of time on this, but it's an electronic application. And once you submit your letter of intent, you'll get information on how to upload your application to NACEF's Box site so that the team will be able to review those materials. But if you'd like to start seeing what those forms are that you'll have to complete, you can find those on the NACEF website. Each standard area has a cover sheet that you would have to complete, and all those cover sheets are available, so you can start working on them at any point during kind of your self-study process. And then just when they're in final form, you'll be able to upload them onto the NACEF website. Onto the Box website that NACEF will send you. And you'll notice that there are different fees for reaccreditation versus the initial accreditation. Then once your accreditation is done, it goes to the peer review team, and this is what it implies. It's your peers. These are volunteers who are coming from accredited programs. The reviewers are generally professionals in concurrent enrollment, like program directors, faculty liaisons, or other concurrent enrollment staff. And they'll come from outside the system that is seeking accreditation so that there's no conflict of interest. And so those peers will review your application. They might ask you some more questions, and you'll even have a chance to meet with your peers or do a conference call with your peers in the fall of your application year to do just further clarification of your application. And then in the spring, the results of that review go to the Accreditation Commission to make the final determination. Okay, Kim?
Great. Thank you so much, Jacqueline and Victoria. We'll get started on the Q&A in just a second, but before that, I want to take the time to give a plug for a couple of NACIP events that are coming up. So first is our Washington Policy Seminar, which is taking place May 1st and 2nd. If you have any policy interest at all, we're taking a group of folks to D.C. to meet with policymakers in the area, other nonprofit organizations that work on education issues day in and day out. And we're going to have, 2 days worth of hammering away at all the policy issues, and we hope that you will join us. We've mentioned our conference a couple of times. That's taking place October 26th to 28th in Chicago, but I specifically want to mention that on the 26th, as one of our pre-conference workshops, we are hosting a full-day accreditation institute. So for those of you who like what you heard today and you want to get more in-depth about the standards and how to go about accreditation, you really should join us for that. It's not to be missed. We also do occasionally host accreditation institutes in conjunction with our state partners. So if you are interested in hosting one of these institutes in your state, then please let me know because we'd love to bring it to you. As Jacqueline briefly mentioned, we do offer a volunteer pre-accreditation coaching program where we connect members who are undergoing the state study with mentors who are experienced with the process. And if you want us to help you out with that, you can contact any one of us. Like I said, my email is kmobley@nacep.org, and I'd be happy to pass you along to the Accreditation Commission to make that happen. I'm going to now unmute all the lines for Q&A. So but please do remember to keep your own personal line muted if you're not going to be making a question. See here.
Your line is now unmuted.
All right. So with that, does anybody have any questions for either Jacqueline or Victoria or Tim, who volunteered to talk about reaccreditation?
I do have a question.
Can you please also introduce yourself before you...
This is Peggy. I'm from Central Methodist University in Missouri. When you talk about the enrollment process has to be the same as on campus, what happens when you are slowed down by bad weather and it slows all your enrollments down, and so they're coming in after the class has started, after, and we were getting enrollments like up to, a couple weeks after the class had started just because of snow and everything being slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
How do we address that?
We had the same situation in our area, and we are still processing registration forms. We understand things like that happen, but what we're getting at is what is your system, the process that you have in place to try to get registrations in a timely manner, and not wanting to see that that a program just as a matter of course is registering students at the very end of the semester. That would not be okay. But basically, we understand that things get in the way sometimes. Issues happen, days off, school, whatever. That's okay.
And I think, Peggy, too, that the common way is that most of us have a few weeks at the beginning of each semester where we're processing these applications, just because nobody's got a great way to do this without lots of paper and manual entry. So we don't expect that on your first day of campus classes that all of your concurrent enrollment students are in. That's absolutely not what we're looking for. We just want to make sure that they don't get a grade and then say, now I want the college credit, right? So,
yay.
And we all have to deal with weather issues, acts of God, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that's a great question.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is Tim Spetter. I think I'm the pink smiley face box on your screen. But we experienced some of this, too, with a lot of schools doing beginning of year, parent night, curriculum night, things like that that typically happen in September or even early October, where that's when a lot of the parents or students are really there asking questions about college credit, how it works, things like that. So we do have a little bit of leeway like that before an official deadline hits. But once that deadline hits, it's only through very extreme circumstances that we would register someone after that.
Okay, great.
Anyone else? Jump right in.
Yes, I do have a question. This is Pam Brown from Quinnebaug Valley Community College in Connecticut. Victoria, you mentioned obviously that these students are non-degree, non-matriculated students.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, do schools have other kinds of designators that identify the cohort as being through their concurrent enrollment program?
Well, we have, I mean, that's really, it's again, so that's a campus by campus, how registrars manage it. I mean, in our internal record system, there is another designation, a student population code that we have, and a section code that each of our schools has a different section number. And so there are various ways internally in our record system that they're being tracked as being concurrent enrollment. But when it comes down to what shows on a college transcript, you can't tell. It just shows the semester and the name of the course and the credits. It doesn't have any other designation saying that this was offered in a high school or anything like that. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. Well, we do that in Connecticut as well, but the follow-up to that is, do colleges show the students that are in your concurrent enrollment program as being part of your registration population for that semester, or are they not included in those numbers?
Oh, when they report out data for states and everything?
Correct. When you do your enrollment numbers for this semester.
They normally are in New York State. They ask us to report our concurrent enrollment populations at our census dates and then confirm that at the end of the semester. But when we just do our so they are included in that, but because they're tracked separately, generally we do, when we talk about our campus populations and enrollments, we only talk about our regular campus students,
okay,
not concurrent enrollment. So, but our state requires that we are reporting the concurrent enrollment population, and so I think that's really a state-by-state call, how those students are being reported and when. But since we're part of a public university, and so we're collecting their state aid on those students and so on. I mean, we have to have them reported whenever
we're
enrollments.
In Indiana, we also report concurrent enrollment numbers, but it's after the census day for our fall and spring semesters, because concurrent enrollment students are considered special status, non-degree seeking. So the state wants the reports for the degree seeking students separately from the concurrent enrollment. So I would suspect that's the same way for most of us. But it's kind of shady to lump everybody together, because those students are going to, it's not helpful for your campus either to lump them together, because those concurrent enrollment students are going to bring down your degree completion rates, you know, in the on-time sense.
Exactly.
They definitely because they're non-matrix, they definitely need to be reported separately from any first-time, full-time students. You need to make sure that they don't get lumped in with anything along those lines.
Okay, so they don't appear in your total FTE numbers then, or do they?
I don't think they do in Indiana.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for us, they do get in our total FTE numbers, because that's affecting our aid formulas, but when our college calculates any other kinds of student success rates for the campus, they're excluded from that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Matrix.
I have a question.
I show that we've... Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Deb Aiken from the Community College of Rhode Island. Did I hear that courses and grades need to be reported on the college transcript?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
For concurrent enrollment, we only post earned credit if the student matriculates at CCRI. We do not. We post the grades internally, but we don't post it on the transcript. So we would need to do that going forward.
It sounds like your system maybe is more almost like articulated credit.
Correct.
They don't get the credit unless they actually attend your institution and matriculate there.
Right.
And that is really a distinction to make from concurrent enrollment, at least as how NACEP defines it, that the idea is that these credits and concurrent enrollment should be transportable. The student should have a college transcript that's being generated immediately when they're taking the course and be able to take those credits to transfer anywhere after graduating high school and not have it be dependent on attending your college or enrolling in a specific major.
We agree with that. So we're working on that piece with others. Thank you for that.
Anybody else? I said there's about 1 minute left.
Yeah, this is Dana from Idaho. And I may have missed this earlier, but is the Prezi going to be available on the website? I just have a situation I'm working out with one of our institutions, and this would be very helpful for me to bring the administration up to speed quickly on an issue.
Yep, this and the recording of the webinar will be available online shortly.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this is Victoria. I just remember that before the Prezi, when there was just the survey that was done of participants, someone had asked about online trainings. And I just wanted to raise that it is okay to have some of your orientation or trainings be in online formats. That the thing to keep in mind is for the F standards that we take a holistic approach in reviewing the evidence and understand that holding an on-campus session in all cases, like for every discipline, every year, it just may not always work, and that each program is going to be a little unique in what maybe if you have some schools that are very far away that you might use distance learning, webinars, various online formats to communicate. And so there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a thing of, we'd be concerned if everything was only taking place through distance and that there was never any contact. So let's say if you had some online trainings, well, then we would want to make sure, well, that you have regular site visits that are taking place often so that liaisons are having real contact with the teachers. So that's just something to keep in mind, kind of, that we do look at this holistically. There isn't one right way to do all of these different things around orientation or so on.
Thanks, Victoria. Does anybody else have a final question? All right, great. With that, I will give a final thanks to our presenters, Jacqueline and Victoria, and thanks to all of the you who have joined. If you do think of any questions following the presentation, feel free to email any one of us, or like it says on your screen, you can email accreditation@nacep.org, and we'd be happy to get back to you. And like I said, this will be posted on our website shortly, so if you have any problems finding that, just feel free to send us a note, and we will point you in the right direction. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.